from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
No one in California, indeed no one in America, should remain in jail solely because they cannot afford bail.
The bail system in California is broken and discriminatory and needs to be reformed, so says Attorney General Javier Becerra. A bipartisan group of lawmakers and the state's chief justice. Backers of the current system say nothing gets people to show up for court like cash bail. We'll take up the issue for bail reform. Join us next, right after this. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. California and other states look to be on the verge of reforming their bail systems. Lawmakers and the state's top judge say the current system disproportionately punishes the poor and traps people in jail for small crimes they may not even have committed. Advocates for the current system say cash bail is the best way to ensure people show up for court. And we're going to take up the debate. Let me tell you who's joining us. I want to welcome Marisa Lagos here in studio, reporter with KQED's Politics and Government Desk. Good morning, Marisa.
Good morning, Michael.
Good to have you. Also good to have Stanford Law Professor Robert Weisberg back with us, co-director of Stanford's Criminal Justice Center. Welcome, Professor Weisberg.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. And we'll also say good morning to Jeffrey Clayton, who joins us this morning from Los Angeles. He is executive director of the American Bail Coalition. Welcome, Jeffrey Clayton.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. Marisa, let's begin with you, and let's begin on a local case which actually has state implications and has consequences for the state. In fact, we have public defender Jeff Adachi saying this is now the law of the land, and apparently Attorney General Becerra agrees. This goes back to a fellow by the name of Kenneth Humphrey, here in San Francisco, who apparently broke into an apartment and stole a bottle of a $5 bottle of cologne?
That's right. And intimidated a neighbor. I mean, it was not, you know, he didn't just grab it and run, but it was, it was not a huge theft, I think.
Threatened to put a pillowcase over the neighbor?
Yeah. And these are men who lived in a subsidized housing. And, you know, he was an elderly person who had struggled on and off through his life with drug addiction.
But they put a $350,000 bail and actually had to stay in jail. I mean, that's the whole issue here, really, isn't it?
Right. He's been in jail. And so this kind of gets back to step back just a second, if we can. We have seen the public defender in San Francisco challenging bail in a number of forums in the last couple of years. One of them was a lawsuit that basically is questioning the constitutionality. That is a separate case. What Jeff Adachi also decided to do was to begin basically challenging almost every case when the bail amount was set too high for a defendant to afford it. And this case made it up to the appellate court. And what was interesting is that the fairly new Attorney General, Javier Becerra, he's been in office for a little over a year, decided instead of doing what the AG has historically done, which is basically back up the local prosecutor and just agree with whatever they did in the case, he made some filings and some arguments where he said, yeah, I don't think that the local courts looked at the three things that the law basically says they're supposed to look at, which is whether or not this person poses a public safety threat, whether or not they'll return to court. And in this case, the big thing is whether they can afford this bail. And so the appellate court wrote this, I would say, and I'm interested to hear the law professor's view, but really remarkable ruling where they basically ordered the San Francisco court to take a new look at this. And to consider the financial resources of the defendant. But to me, what was remarkable is that they really inserted themselves into this broader debate over the efficacy and fairness of bail. I mean, they closed this basically saying we are not blind to the practical problems our ruling might present because this could really upend how people get out. But they essentially said that the entire case stems from, quote, the enduring unwillingness of our society, including the courts, to correct a deformity in our criminal justice system that close observers have long considered a blight on the system. And so they have ordered this case back for reconsideration. Humphrey may be in court this morning, actually. But the attorney general and others are saying that this could basically have statewide implications for any defendant who is sitting in jail, not because they pose a public safety risk or potential one, but because they just don't have the money to buy their way out.
Well, they say against keep somebody in prison due solely to poverty. The word poverty keeps coming up here. You know?
Exactly. And I think that that's something that, you know, a lot of folks who have been pushing bail reform in the Capitol in recent years have been really focusing on, that they believe, and I know that not everybody thinks this, but that if you are rich and you are a danger, that, you know, you can basically buy your way out. And if you are poor, that you will languish in jail, and that there are a lot of other implications other than just public safety. Right. If you are sitting in jail for 3 months while you await trial, you probably lose your job. You might lose your housing. You might lose custody of your kids. And so both in this case and then some other actions we've seen by the courts, I think, including the Chief Justice really standing up and endorsing this idea of reform, to me, shows just like a really interesting shift underway in the way that not just lawmakers and advocates view this, but the judicial system, and they have so much power in this.
Well, they're also talking about some serious questions here with respect to people being put in jail and not necessarily being given a trial, or certainly have to sit in jail for long periods of time without giving a trial. But there are real issues in this about public safety, and we'll get into those as
Yeah, but I also want to mention, too, like, I think the other thing that this gets to that is not often talked about in this bail thing, but is another huge part of the criminal justice system, which is plea deals, which I would say, you know, is something that a lot of people are also taking a hard look at. If you if your only way to get out is to cop a plea, basically, I think that there's a real question about coercion in some cases. And so this case, again, kind of hits on that. And it is a really, it seems to me, significant ruling.
Can we also talk just briefly about how this is moving along legislative lanes? I mean, you got SB 20 in the works, actually went through the assembly. And now the governor blocked it the last time, and now the governor's in process of talking.
Well, so there were two bills. SB 10 actually made it out of the Senate. There were two identical bills. AB 42 died in the assembly. The Senate has passed a bail reform. SB 10 is now sitting in appropriations, where it has been since last year.
Sure, I think I said SB 20.
Yeah.
I meant SB 10. Yeah,
there's so many bills. But, you know, this bill would essentially...
It's Hertzberg and Bonita. Yeah.
Yeah, this is Bob Hertzberg from L.A. and Robert Bonta from Oakland. And they have this bill that would essentially institute a system statewide that would require these pretrial service agencies, which essentially are sort of an alternative to bail, where they look at an inmate and do an assessment for the court and say, look, maybe you can let this person out, but they need an ankle monitor, or they need to check in weekly with a probation officer. So there's sort of alternatives that do not involve money bail. It is very controversial. It's been opposed by the bail industry. Jeff Clayton will talk about that, I'm sure. It's also been opposed by some in law enforcement, although others are in favor of reform. And it kind of got put on hold because of that opposition, but also because the governor and the chief justice agreed to come to the table and talk about it. But they asked them to wait till this year while the chief justice finished up a report that came out in the fall, which was conducted by a bunch of judges and really made a very strong case again for this reform, and essentially said our current system is broken. And so it's kind of been in a holding pattern. I think the big question now is, how much does the governor engage? How much does the chief justice engage? And what can they do to maybe mollify some of the critics on law enforcement side, but also to figure out a way to pay for this? Because things cost money, and pretrial service agencies are not going to happen for free. And I don't think counties are all going to have the money to do it. So there's a lot of
questions. We're also
talking
about a great deal of expense, possibly, in monitoring people or making sure that they're going to show up for their court dates and all the rest of
it. All of that. And also in making sure that they get a speedy hearing before a judge. I mean, that's part of the reason a lot of people post bail. If you get arrested on a Friday night and you have the money, you're going to buy your way out. You're not going to wait till Monday or Tuesday. And so, you know, there's a lot of sort of moving parts around changing this system that I think the authors are finding challenging to deal with, but I think they're hopeful that they can get something done.
Marisa Lagos, reporter for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk, here with us in studio. She mentioned that she'd like to hear what Professor Weisberg has to say about this. And Robert Weisberg, professor of law at Stanford and co-director of Stanford's Criminal Justice Center at the law school. Judge Tony Klein said, and let me quote this and get your response, Professor Weisberg, it's the responsibility of the trial judge to ensure a defendant not be held in custody solely because he or she lacks financial resources.
The justice is correct. Indeed, in effect, this was a ruling about the constitutionality of the bail system, even though in a sense it was just about this particular case. There's something odd and often overlooked about the Constitution and bail, and I'm referring to both the federal Constitution and the Eighth Amendment and its California parallel. These provisions do not require that people be eligible for bail, in the sense that it's not unconstitutional to just flat out declare that someone poses such a risk of never showing up in court or possibly a risk to public safety that he can't be let out under any circumstances. It does require that if bail be provided or set, it has to be reasonable. Reasonable means, I think, the following. The person has to put up at risk some resources which he is capable of putting up, but which in effect he can't afford to lose. That's the kind of sweet spot balance that we're trying to achieve.
Forgive me, Professor. We're talking about people in many instances who have no resources, aren't we? A great number of them.
Ironically comical about the fact that the trial judge, having originally agreed to bail of $600,000, magnanimously reduced it to $350,000. It's a dishonest trial court decision in the sense that, you know, Mr. Humphrey could not afford any of these fees. If he were to go to the private bail bondsman, which is the usual way of doing it, he'd have to have, let's say, from the if we were talking about the $350,000, $35,000 that he could simply give up irrevocably in order to have the bail bondsman put up the full 100%. Needless to say, Mr. Humphrey didn't have $35,000, and he certainly didn't have $60,000. So manipulating the numbers like that is meaningless because, in effect, then, what the judge was doing was denying him any possibility of pretrial release. And first of all, that's disingenuous and dishonest. Second of all, it's technically unconstitutional, although the constitutional aspect of this has been neglected in recent years.
We're also talking about California specifically has a bail schedule that's five times the national average. And on any given day, according to some data I was looking at, nearly two-thirds of inmates in California jails really haven't been convicted of a crime.
Right. First of all, you refer to California's bail schedule. There are actually 58 bail schedules because California state law authorizes or permits counties, county courts, to set their own bail schedules. And there are huge variations among them, and then they don't make a lot of sense. Second of all, as you're suggesting, in county jails, there are basically two kinds of people. There are those who are serving their sentences, largely for misdemeanors, though after California's realignment law went into effect, a lot of them are serving time for felonies. But the rest have been charged with misdemeanors or felonies and were unable to make own recognizance release or make bail and are awaiting trial there. The percentage of people in jail for pretrial in California, 60-65%, is way, way higher than the national average. And there's no particularly good explanation for it, nor is there any evidence that that number has been efficacious in controlling crime in California.
What about racial bias? That's been brought into this argument as well.
Well, the most obvious aspect of racial bias is simply that at some level, race and poverty are correlated. And obviously, people who can't afford to make high bail are likely to be poor. And there's obviously a racial disparity there. It's interesting that in many of the measures, which are popular but also controversial, for using various so-called algorithms, risk-based models or profiles for assessing the risk of letting somebody out, those models are often framed in very neutral terms. They're always framed in neutral terms, but their factors, past criminal history, education, and so on, tend to at least correlate very often with race as well as poverty.
In fact, I would refer to an article by Judge Quentin Kopp, a name that's certainly recognizable to many in the Bay Area, about that use of algorithms and computers in terms of trying to determine safety of somebody who is released. And that's a big question in this that I'm going to go to you with, Jeffrey Clayton. I mean, Executive Director Jeffrey Clayton of the American Bail Coalition. The argument from the bail business, which is a multi-billion-dollar industry, I mean, let's get that right up in front here, and also the fact that many in the bail industry concede that it's an inequitable situation we have. I'd like to ask you whether you feel that way, but the argument in many instances goes back to public safety?
Yeah, I think so. But I think, to continue this conversation about the algorithm, I think that's an important component to this case, because the algorithm used in San Francisco evaluated Kenneth Humphrey, and it said he shouldn't get out of jail at all. It said he should have been preventatively detained. So if we're going to adopt the Chief Justice's system and we're going to adopt Senate Bill 10, Kenneth Humphrey is not getting bail, and I think that's a problem. And the algorithm said he shouldn't get out. I think the other thing about the case that really struck me was what the court said, the unquestioning reliance on bail schedules. And the prosecutor didn't put on hardly a shred of evidence here. And for that reason, I think this case was properly decided. Maybe the bail should have been lower. But I think what the point of this case is, and what we've been saying all along, and certainly I agree with Public Defender Jeff Adachi, is stop relying so heavily on the bail schedules, which, as we know, are too high, and the Little Hoover Commission and we have said should be reduced for the last 5 years and have gotten no movement on that. But stop relying on this and have individual consideration after the schedule. And that just didn't happen in this case. I would point out the court did affirm that the use of the schedules is constitutional and allowable within California. But the point is, we need more individualized consideration. And the prosecutor has to prove something before somebody's just going to get a high bail like that.
So you're saying make the board of bail affordable, reform the high cost of the bail?
I think so, and we've been advocating for this for a long time. The reality is bail is so cheap in California because agents are taking so much risk on these bonds, and nobody's collecting $35,000 on a $350,000 bond very often because the bails are just way too high. And I think Kenneth Humphrey could have gotten out on a reasonable bail if the schedules were lower, I think. Well, hard to say.
There are a lot of different bail schedules, as Professor Weisberg said, but the bail schedule is much higher in California than nationally.
Yeah, and San Francisco's the highest bail schedules in the nation. I've never seen anything even approaching it. And we have long advocated that should be decreased.
What do you do about the fact that many are arguing that this actually, this bail system ensures the fact that the jails are overcrowded, and in fact are overcrowded indeed because of the bail system?
Well, it's really other holds that's driving the pretrial incarceration. The other argument that, people haven't been convicted, that's not exactly accurate. They haven't been convicted of the present offense. They've been convicted usually of many other offenses, and the criminal history profile of the offender in California is much higher than the rest of the country because of progressive criminal justice policies in California.
Well, I'm going to ask for our listeners to weigh in on this. In fact, I'd like to hear from you and not only hear your thoughts, but California is likely headed for major bail reform, and it's going on nationally. There's a lot of momentum. Let me give you a number to call, though, if you'd like to join the conversation with any questions or comments. In fact, we invite you to do that now, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. The number to call, 866-733-6786. Again, you can join us live at that number right now, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org is our email address, or go to our website and post questions or comments there, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Marisa Lagos.
I just wanted to jump in on this idea that Jeff mentioned, because I've heard this from bail agents, too, that, you're innocent until proven guilty. But a lot of these people have already been proven guilty. But that's not the point. And I agree that, of course, a court should be looking at somebody's entire history when they're deciding if they're a public safety risk. But the bottom line is, we have a constitution for a reason. And being, being in jail on suspicion of something is not, it doesn't mean you've been convicted of it. And so I think that is a bit of a slippery slope. And it's something I've heard before. And I don't really understand how that's a good argument to be making, particularly when, as you brought up, we have had a system that has historically set far harsher penalties and charges against people of color and other people, minorities who have not had the same opportunities. And so I do think that in some cases, clearly somebody has done something violent and we should consider that when we look at whether they should be let out. But in other cases, you might want to consider the fact that their race or socioeconomic status could have something to do with that criminal history.
And you say what to that, Jeffrey Clayton?
I agree with that. I think ultimately, for me, the best way to assign bail would be based on the alleged conduct and not look at anything else. And that's the purest way to protect the presumption of innocence, but that doesn't happen in this country. And I guess, my simple point was that, you don't have a bunch of first-time offenders sitting there and judges are considering the criminal histories. And, of course, the impact of other holds, I think, is much more significant than unposted bails in California.
And what do we do, Robert Weisberg, about the fact that, I'm sure you've heard this argument, that people are being held, and they're being held for the reasons that have to do, in many cases, with their poverty, and they're not being able to meet bail. But at the same time, we're protecting the public by holding them, so the argument goes.
By the way, could I just ask that my sound go up a little?
Okay. I hope the engineer hears that. And
I hope my engineer can hear me.
Yeah. I'm not. Are you hearing me okay now?
And now that's much better. Thank you. So your question was about...
Well, the question has to do... I mean, because a lot of people who defend the system say it's an assurance that the person is going to show up in court, and they need to be monitored if they don't... if they're released, despite their poverty or whatever may be involved.
Well, that raises an empirical question about the predictability of appearance in court. California's failure to appear rate is at least as high as the national average and generally higher, which is ironic given that, on the whole, of course, it's got the harshest pretrial rules and pretrial rates. Failure to appear can mean a lot of things, and when you see statistics about failure to appear, they're really kind of mushy because, you know, many people think that failure to appear means that the defendant has, fled the jurisdiction, and is, in some kind of premeditated way to avoid ever facing prosecution. Most poor defendants don't have the resources to do that, and a great number of people who were alleged to have failed to appear are basically hanging around or near the courthouse totally confused, in part because their lives are pretty disorganized and in part because they're not exactly sure where to show up. But I also want to just emphasize that failure to appear doesn't necessarily correlate with, in fact, may not correlate at all with the public safety matter, which up until about 30 years ago was, in theory, not supposed to be an issue for pretrial detention at all because of the presumption of innocence and the constitutional argument against pretrial detention. In the 1980s, the Supreme Court sort of finally acknowledged, what was probably a fact all along, that fear of harm based on the charge alleged was a factor to be taken into account. But it can't be taken into account as a categorical matter, as Mr. Clayton suggests, because that has to violate the presumption of innocence then.
I'm going to read some comments that are coming in, and you can add your voice. We invite you to do that by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum. Joseph writes, bail is a delaying topic on both sides. If trials really were speedy, then there would be no need for bail. Instead, the defendant is asked to waive time, bail out, and then the games begin. This can go on for months, even years. Lawyers get rich, and no justice is served. There's another listener who writes, our society is based on the principle that we cannot punish people until they are proven guilty. The current bail system not only punishes innocent people, it ruins their lives. It is indefensible under the values of our society. Again, add your voice here by email or by going to our website or tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum. And again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. And just to add to the mix, there's a bipartisan bill that went through Congress, actually went through the Senate. Kamala Harris, Senator from California, and Rand Paul from Kentucky got a $30 million in grant for states actually to engage in bail reform. That's something else that we're going to continue to talk about here as we talk about California bail reform and talk about what's likely to happen in terms of major bail reform. It's headed that way. Even Governor Brown's on board now. And I see even Governor Brown, because at first, Marisa, he was not necessarily on board with legislation. So you got the Chief Justice here in California, you've got Governor Brown, and you have the Attorney General, and we'll hear from you when we return. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and we are discussing bail. There is a movement not only here in California, but nationwide to move toward bail reform, particularly in light of the fact that many people who are in poverty are put in jail and they have to wait because they can't afford the bail, whatever the bail schedule may be. Marisa Lagos with us in studio, reporter for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk, who has been covering this. And Jeffrey Clayton with us by phone from L.A. is executive director of the American Bail Coalition. And Robert Weisberg is also with us by phone from Stanford, professor of law at Stanford and co-director of the Stanford Criminal Justice Center at the Stanford Law School. Let me go to our callers and let's begin with Holly. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, everyone. I joined the conversation a little bit late, but I was curious about whether you all have been looking at models in other cities, like in New York City, the Bail Project, which uses staff to ensure that people show up for court. In the meantime, they are covering the bail for poor people instead of the bail bondsmen. and people are able to return to their lives and are helped to return to court. And when I left, the last time I looked at the statistics, when I left New York, the return rate to court was astonishingly high. I think they had a failure rate of only 1% or 2%. So just I'll take my listen off air, but I just wondered about that. I think it's really important that people be able to return to their lives and also show up and be accountable for whatever harm they've caused.
I thank you for that, Holly. And Marisa has a response.
So Holly brought up a couple of things I really did want to touch on, so I'm glad she did. One is this issue of, you know, the professor also talked about reminders. So one of the things that we've found in California already that really works in some jurisdictions is a simple text message reminding people where and when to be in court. So there are really easy, low-cost things that actually increase those appearance rates dramatically, and I think that that's important to talk about. And to the point about this idea of a community bail fund, that is indeed something that I know San Francisco, for example, has been looking at. San Francisco had that model about 25 years ago. A state law that I think in part was helped push by the bail industry changed it so that is not, according to a lot of readings, legal under state law anymore, that you can't have this type of fund. I know it's something that cities like San Francisco have been exploring. I think in some ways there's a desire to do a bigger overhaul, and so they may not be pushing that type of legislation at the state level. But I would expect that if we saw SB 10 fail and you know, the conversation around a bigger statewide push, that we might see some attempts to at least bite off some of these smaller things that municipalities can do. And it's important to say that, you know, I know that there's some debate over the tool that's used in San Francisco and elsewhere. Jeff brought that up. I think there are valid questions about these tools. I think there needs to be a lot of transparency around it, because just like bail and a judge's decision and a bail schedule, you should know as a defendant and as the public why a tool works a certain way if it says that I, Marisa, am safe or unsafe for release. But that said, there has been a push here, Santa Clara, some other places, to really embrace that type of technology. And so I do think that that's an important conversation to be having again, is like, what's the best technology and how is it working? And if it's not working in the correct ways or it needs to be tweaked, that should be looked at. Those algorithms, though, are not, you know, I think it's important to note that there's still a judicial discretion involved in that. So, you know, Humphrey may have been assessed by the algorithm as unsafe for release. A judge could overrule that. And so some of what this is about, I would say, is the fact that, you know, our high bail schedules and the way our system is set up, I think there's a lot of fear on the part of the judiciary that if they let that one person out who does something terrible, you know, the Willie Horton situation, that they will be recalled or held responsible. And so I think there's been some reliance on, you know, the bail schedules and just sort of doing the easiest thing.
Well, I mentioned the article by Quentin Kopp, and what he uses as an example, it wasn't necessarily a Willie Horton example, but there was a Twin Peaks homicide here in San Francisco of a photographer alleged by a felon who was decreed to have had his release based on an algorithm, and the release went forward. There is also this whole question of fixed amounts as opposed to looking at the defendant's records, and this is also, I think, part of the whole debate and discussion we're having. But I want to get more of our callers on, and let me go Bob next to you. Bob, you're on.
Hi. I have a question. I got a ticket in San Francisco. In order for me to fight the ticket, I had to pay the ticket first. I'm wondering, if I hadn't had the money to pay the ticket, what would I have done? In other words, you've got to pay to play. I don't get it.
Well, let me ask the professor. Professor Weisberg, can you explain this from your perspective?
Well, first of all, I presume that was an infraction. It probably wasn't even a misdemeanor. So what we think of as the constitutional rights of criminal defendants wouldn't really apply here. But I do think the notion that you have to pay up front before contesting anything is part of how the bail system fits into a larger troublesome picture of American justice. It's not to jump too much out of the context, but you recall after the Ferguson incident several years ago, and putting aside the police shooting, what was discovered about the city of Ferguson is that it was making a fortune on various kinds of fines and forfeitures, coming from from poor people. Criminal justice systems, law enforcement agencies often rely on these things a great deal. So the risk that a poor person will be stuck because of an inability to pay is a very serious one. Now, most jurisdictions, in the case of an infraction, will probably work out a little settlement, but I can understand why it's a problem. I'm much more concerned, though, with people who are facing jail time for misdemeanors or felonies and not for infractions.
Let me thank Bob for that call and go to a couple of listener comments. Here's a listener who writes, the legal system in the United States where convicting someone at any cost is the name of the game is unfair and unjust, especially with all of the racial biases and poor defendants who lack adequate representation. That is one side of the argument. And here's Rick, who says, there are over 30,000 car robberies in San Francisco every year. Since Proposition 47 passed, crime has spiked. Let's keep these criminals locked up. Who cares what their economic status or their races? And Chris says, don't commit crimes, and it's not a problem. And we go to more of your calls. And again, you can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or by email forum@kqed.org. Here's Damien. Good morning. You're on the air.
Morning. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate the panel's discussion here. My comment would be that bail is your ability to bail out as a defendant is crucial to getting a good hearing in court, and judges do have some discretion over sentencing. And there's a huge disparity between people that come in that are still incarcerated, that come in from the box and are wearing their jail blues and are getting sentenced by a judge, as opposed to somebody that has time to delay their court case a little bit, prove good behavior, and have their lawyer defend them, you know, in a suit and tie from the other side, and they have a generally better outcome. So it's not just about people getting bail so they can get back to their life. It's about them having a better chance to defend themselves in front of a judge.
Let me go to you on this, Jeffrey Clayton, because as I said earlier, there are many in your business, in the bail bond business, who say it isn't an equitable system, just like Damien's saying, and concede that fact. And what would you say to Damien's comment?
Well, I think there are certainly inequities in the system, and I think he makes an important point, which is that the goal should be able to should be to get people out of jail so that they can prepare their defense. And Chief Justice Rehnquist, as the professor mentioned, is probably turning in his grave right now, because he said liberty should be the norm and detention the carefully limited exception in this country. And of course, that hasn't been, you know, what we've seen in the federal system of preventative detention, a 303% increase in detention. And so this whole idea of dangerousness in the equation over a generation has led to what I would call mass incarceration in the pretrial context. The example of New York City that was brought up by the other caller is an important point, because dangerousness is not a consideration in New York City. It's simply an appearance bond. They're one of four states. And that's why the bonds are so low. And, of course, the charitable program, they bail people out on bonds of less than, you know, $2,000. And certainly I would propose the charitable, some version of the charitable program, if we could somehow be involved in it. But I think the bonds are too high in California right now for it to work.
Robert Weisberg, you want to respond to the comment about Chief Justice Rehnquist that was made by Jeffrey Clayton?
I think that's very generous to the late Chief Justice, who, if anything, was validating in the relevant case, the Salerno case, the importance of focusing on danger, which had, you know, been kind of put aside because it's sort of an embarrassment as a constitutional matter. I'd rather focus, if I may, for just a second on this business of the disadvantage in your ultimate conviction or sentence of having been incarcerated pretrial. First of all, well, yes, it is. It does make it much more difficult to assist your lawyer, assuming you have one, in preparing a defense. But I just want to emphasize what the dilemma is. You sit in jail for months and months and months. Technically, you're not being punished. You're just being held pretrial. Then, with or without the advice of a lawyer, and often without the advice of a lawyer, you are well advised to plead guilty, because then your so-called non-punishment pretrial detention magically gets transformed into your punishment, because the judge will give you credit for time served and not sentence you to jail time going forward, so long as you plead guilty at that point. This is a very, very coercive system. And it's hypocritical, you know, for the reasons I just described.
I'd like to actually follow up. Marisa wants to add her voice here, but I'm looking at a question I'd like to ask you, Professor Weisberg, from Karen, who says, where does being released on one's own recognizance fit into this discussion?
A fair number of people get released on their own recognizance. They are the ones who are deemed not flight risks or risks of other kinds. It's not an either or, because the pretrial detention services, which are unevenly resourced in California, but some are very good, serve as a supervisory function, somewhat similar to parole and probation. Conditions can be set for ROR so that the likelihood of showing up, for next court appearance can be very, very high.
Marisa?
Yeah, so I just... I agree with everything the professor said. I also wanted to bring up or note something that I think Jeff mentioned that I think is a really important point, which is this idea of preventative detention. And, the federal system is very different. But I think it gets to another sort of area of discretion that we haven't talked about, which is prosecutors and what they do in this whole situation to ask for high bail amounts and to support them. And the sense I've got from even people who are very like reform minded and support this idea that the bail system should be changed is that a lot of DAs are still okay with asking for exorbitantly high bails they know a defendant can't pay, but they would never ask for preventative detention, when essentially those are the same things, right? And so I think that that's an interesting one, and I think it gets to some of the cultural shifts that, go way beyond bail around criminal justice reform that make it so difficult, because you can have the governor and everybody agree, but the people on the ground do the work, right? One other just quick point about this idea, I think, of equity. I had done a story earlier last year about just San Francisco specifically, and I think this is a really important point, which is that in San Francisco, basically, African-American and Latino residents were 63% of those posting bail and only 21% of the city's population. And so, within that, I think some of the inequities we've talked about are really illustrated. And, it's important to note this is money people don't get back. Even if their charges are dropped or they get proven innocent in a criminal case, the amount that you paid a bail bondsman, they keep. And so that is, I think that sometimes people don't really understand the way bail works. And of course, that's how bail agents make their money. It makes sense for them. But it is, that is money out of your pocket. Whereas if you are, a wealthy person and you have a lot of money in the bank, you can just give that to the court and you will indeed get back every penny when your case is adjudicated.
Is it not also true, Jeffrey Clayton, that the bail bonds industry, I don't know if I'm speaking for you, but or if you're speaking for yourself or the industry here when I ask you this question, are the major supporters of the system as it presently exists?
Well, I think so, and I'm not sure we support it as it presently exists. I mean, we have our own reforms that we're putting out to try to, like I said, lower the schedules and enhance due process in the very area that we're talking about in the Humphrey case. So I'm not sure we're defending the system as it stands right now. I would say in California, the roadblock to reform is generally not us. It's the local counties that don't want to spend the money on these programs. It's the prosecutor, as Marisa said, that they don't want to change their culture. Maybe they don't want to go for the reforms. There's widespread opposition just besides us to moving to this no money bail system.
Comment from a listener named Nancy: while it will cost counties to pay for pretrial release services, this is probably cheaper than keeping people in jail, feeding them, giving them medical care, and so on. Let me go to more of your calls. Let's go next to you, Scott, and thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Great. My idea is to reduce bails over time. So we set the bails as we do now. I think the judges are busy enough without learning new algorithms, and I think they fundamentally don't want to be told what to do. Let them set the bails they want to do, that they want to set, but then reduce the bail 10% per month or something like that. And I think a natural balance would happen. Inmates can decide, what is affordable, what's fair. Eventually that bail will reduce to something that is affordable and fair. And I think it encourages speedy trials, too. If a prosecutor is really serious about a particular case, I think they're going to get on that case and do it in this kind of a system.
Jeffrey Clayton, what do you say to Scott's suggestion?
Well, first, I agree with speedy trial. When the Federal Bail Reform Act of 84 was passed, a law professor from Harvard came in and told the committee that speedy trial has the potential to reduce pretrial incarceration by 50%, just overall, by simply speeding up the cases. I can absolutely agree with that suggestion. And I do think a phase-in is correct. I mean, I think the concept of X inefficiency, which means everybody can be better off without anybody being worse off, is something we should apply to bail, because I think legitimately our industry can continue, defendants can get cheaper bail, and the system can actually work better if, as the caller said, we would just gradually begin to reduce the bail schedules in California.
And you say what, Robert Weisberg, if I can go back to you?
Well, I'm a little unclear on what this phase-in means. On the one hand, it sounds like it means, as a structural matter, we'll be reducing the bail schedule slowly. But I thought the caller was saying that in an individual case, the person would be required to post, let's say, bail of $40,000. But for every month he behaved well and did whatever he was supposed to, that bail amount would then be reduced. If that's the suggestion, it's an interesting one. But the implementation is very, very complicated because it all depends on exactly how the money was placed, how it's being paid out. It almost sounds like an adjustable mortgage arrangement, and I think it would have a lot of complexity to it.
Well, speaking of complexity, let me read a few more comments, which give some more complex nuance to what we're discussing here. Bruce writes, 2 weeks ago, our car was broken into in Noe Valley. Amazingly, the police made an arrest. The burglar was out on bail for three other auto burglaries. Bail was obviously too low to protect the public. Another listener, Francis, writes, shouldn't all these criminal justice decisions be determined by science? Is there anything in the law that requires the procedures to be proven to work? If there is, do they take into account the damage done to the communities that have been mistreated by the criminal justice system? And the answer, Mace, is no.
No. And I mean, I think, though, this idea of scientific based analysis is really at the heart of the alternative to bail that people are pushing. And as Jeff mentioned earlier, so there's a couple of different tools that counties are using. The one used in San Francisco that's gotten a lot of flack is the Arnold tool. It was created by the Arnold Foundation. At this point, it is proprietary. They are not letting people know sort of what goes into that algorithm to decide if I am too dangerous or likely to appear in court. And they have said, after a lot of pushback and some really good reporting, I'll say, like, there's a ProPublica investigation about some of the inequities that have been built into these algorithms around African Americans and other people of color. And so, you know, I think we do have to be careful. Like, just because it's scientific, quote unquote, doesn't mean that it doesn't, that there aren't people behind it who maybe have instilled some of those same biases.
Had so many cases that have been alluded to on this program about algorithms that did not work or that were misconceived.
Right. But I think that there's also obviously some inherent problems with the system we have. And so I think, you know, what I would say is maybe don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We can talk about how much, you know, as I said earlier, transparency needs to exist in these, and maybe that they are, you know, a developing thing, because the way these algorithms work is the more cases you get, like, the algorithm gets better. It learns.
You hope.
Right.
Let me get some more calls on here. Let me go next to Yogi in Gilroy. Yogi, you're on the air.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. So I'm going to comment specifically on the Humphrey case. This is a person who has had chances in his life but continues to, you know, break laws. Why should he be out on the street? What about the rights of us? My right to live in my house freely and not be threatened by him. We hear a lot about, you know, letting these people go. What about public safety? I'd love to hear that offline, please.
Okay. Actually, I'd like to hear you opine on that, if I could ask you, Robert Weisberg. The caller speaks poignantly about his own concern about his safety with respect to people who are in jail who can't afford bail.
First, if you look at the Humphrey case itself, by the way, it was more than a theft that was charged. It was a burglary and a robbery. But his past crimes, I recall, had been pretty, pretty far back. And he had long stretches of good behavior, and he'd been engaged in a lot of rehab programs, though he obviously was is a very troubled individual. But I think we're confusing two different things. The caller is suggesting that he should be incarcerated for a long time because of his past crimes, and at least the allegation of a new one. But that suggests we're talking about recidivist sentencing, something along the lines of three strikes, habitual offender sentencing. You could argue that his earlier sentences weren't long enough. But if his new alleged crime is to justify a long incarceration because of his past, well, then we have to wait until he's convicted of the new alleged crime. And that simply hadn't happened yet.
Yogi, what do you say to that? Yogi, are you there? Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, Yes, I'm there. I understand what he's saying. But, you know, more and more we're finding, like that other commentator said, that, you know, their car got broken into or stolen. We're letting, you know, it's these people who continuously commit crimes who are being let off. And right. That's where my frustration and concern is.
I understand your frustration, and thank you for expressing it. Michael, appreciate your calling. Marisa Lagos.
Yeah, I just think there's another thing in the Humphreys case that's interesting, which is, you know, I think that the caller's frustration is totally valid. And I think, you know, we have a huge problem with car breaks in San Francisco and things like that. But if you read the Humphrey decision by the appellate court, what's interesting is that a couple things. I mean, they mentioned that he had actually been in and out of treatment and had drug addiction problems. But one of the things the public defender had suggested is that he get released into an inpatient recovery program. And so it was this interesting thing where he basically had a path to sort of help him get better. And the judge decided that he would be better off staying in jail where he's not getting those sorts of services. And that's one thing the court, I think, really looked at closely was what makes the most sense for everyone. And, you know, let's not forget, if somebody gets put out on one of these pretrial release programs and doesn't meet the conditions, they will get put back in jail.
I'm looking at an analysis, and let me go to you on this, if I may, Professor Weisberg. It was released last May by the Assembly Appropriations Committee. It found that reforming the bail system would be costly. It also found that the state would have to spend, quote, hundreds of millions of dollars to reimburse counties for establishing and administering the new pretrial services.
I don't know if there's anything very scientific about that cost prediction. It will be costly, but I have two things to say in that regard. First of all, if the current bail system is unconstitutional, then there are, you know, constitutional rights at issue, you know, and we have to be careful about subjecting them to the same cost-benefit analysis as a merely pragmatic decision. But second of all, it costs $30,000 or $40,000 a year to keep somebody in jail. Surely there are ways of moving money around so that the money now being spent to keep, I think, a disproportionately large number of people in jails pre-trial can be moved over to those services. The money is being spent somewhere. It has to be movable.
I'm reminding you that Robert Weisberg is co-director of Stanford's Criminal Justice Center. We also have Jeffrey Clayton with us, executive director of the American Bail Coalition, and Marisa Lagos here in the studio, who's a reporter with KQED's Politics and Government Desk. Look at a comment here from a listener who writes, my 18-year-old daughter was arrested for having two prescription pills in her purse without a prescription. It was a Friday night, and the bail was set at $10,000. Of course, I put up the $10,000 so she didn't have to spend the weekend in jail. We went to court, had to spend more money for the lawyer and for the classes she was forced to attend. This all just seemed to me to be a moneymaker for California's court system. Let me bring on some more of your calls, and let's go next to a caller in San Francisco. Rose, good morning.
Good morning. So I'm a criminal defense attorney in San Francisco, and I had a case last week where a client was in custody on a misdemeanor case. I filed a bail motion, and the district attorney argued she shouldn't be released for public safety. At the same time, she was actually offering a deal for credit for time served. So arguing at the same time that she shouldn't be released under for bail, but she could be released on a deal. So it just, to me, seemed very intellectually dishonest, but also an example of how district attorneys use the bail system as leverage to get clients to settle cases.
All right. Well, let that statement stand, and I thank you for bringing it into the conversation. I want to get another caller on, and that's Hugh. Good morning.
Good morning. Let me preface this by saying that I believe that the courts still have not received the same amount of funding that they had before the recession, and this seems to be amplifying both this problem as well as family court problems where children are involved, and it's something that it would be great to revisit and that we really need to get our legislatures to take action on. It's a real shame. But my question was to call and ask about how this will affect violent criminals who are gang members, and if there aren't, there's already a big problem with getting fearful potential victims and who are neighbors in Oakland of testifying against people that have inflicted legitimate harm on their communities, mostly minority communities, and what can be done about it. Will these new proposals distinguish between the two, and are there interim measures to get DAs to not overstep their bounds, therefore crying wolf and setting up this situation.
Yeah, a lot embedded in your questions, Hugh, and I thank you for them. Marisa, you want to respond?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of that remains to be seen in terms of the legislation, but I think he hit on a lot of the challenges that exist, right? And in finding a balance between a lot of that, those things. And then, you know, when it comes to prosecutors, I wouldn't hold my breath. I think that, you know, they have a lot of power and independence for, you know, reasons that we have sort of set out in our Constitution and system. And they also have a lot of political muscle. And so I think it'll be important to see the way they engage on this and what they're asking for, because that could really mean the difference between success or failure for the reform folks.
We are going to see legislation, though. That seems abundantly clear at this point.
It's in the legislature. They have until the end of the summer. And so I would expect that at some point we'll see a flurry of action all of a sudden. But right now it seems like it's mostly behind closed doors conversations.
And I'm looking at a tweet from a listener who says, how if a dangerous person pays $50 or $5,000 to get out, they're exactly the same amount of dangerous. A perilous note to end on here, but we do have to bring things to a conclusion. Let me thank all of our guests here. Marisa, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Robert Weisberg.
Thank you.
And thank you, Jeffrey Clayton.
Always great to be on.
And thank you, our listeners. We would not be here without you, and we do appreciate and are grateful for your listenership. KQED Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, Susan Britton, and Penny Nelson. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Steve Asregadu. Steve, I knew I stumbled over your name. Asregadu. And our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. We get online support from Amanda Font. Interns are Lisa Arbatman and Ali Wallner. Managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. Executive producer is Holly Kernan. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.